Crosstown Concourse, and the University of Memphis.
Good morning. This is Phoebe Rowe from the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee, and welcome to Faithfully Memphis on 91.7 FM WYXR here in Memphis, Tennessee. Each week, we have the opportunity to speak with someone to learn about the role of faith in their life and the interesting work they are doing in the community. And we always start the show with a saint of the day. The saint for this week is Absalom Jones. His official saint day is February the 13th, and we remember him because he is the first African-American to be ordained priest in the Episcopal Church. And I would like to tell you a little bit about Absalom's story because it is truly amazing. Absalom was born as an enslaved person in Sussex County, Delaware in 1746. When he was 16 years old, he was sold to a shopkeeper in Philadelphia, and that's where he learned to read at a night school that was run by the Quakers. He got married in 1770, and he purchased his wife's freedom in 1778 so that their children would be free. He subsequently bought his own freedom in 1784 when he was 38 years old. Absalom was truly a God-fearing man, and he was an active member of St. George's Methodist Church, which was an integrated congregation in Philadelphia. He and his good friend Richard Allen were among the first Black men to be licensed as lay preachers in the Methodist Church. And apparently they were incredible evangelists because the number of Black members increased significantly due to their preaching and their outreach. Now, the fact that people were committing their lives to Christ should have been a cause for celebration. But unfortunately, some of the white members were threatened by the increase in Black membership. So church leaders then insisted that the Black folk move from the main worship space downstairs to the balcony. Richard Allen and Absalom Jones refused to accept those conditions, and they continued worshiping downstairs. And that led to a confrontation where the men were dragged out of the church, literally in the middle of their prayers. So Absalom, Richard, and many of the Black members left the Methodist Church at that time because of this disrespectful treatment. They responded by creating the Free African Society in 1787, a civic organization that worked to emancipate enslaved persons and also to support the poor. And they began holding religious services, and in 1794, the Free African Society became the first African Church of Philadelphia. When there was an outbreak of yellow fever in Philadelphia that year, Absalom and Richard worked tirelessly to assist the sick and to bury the dead. And because of their holistic approach to ministry, the First African Church of Philadelphia experienced tremendous growth. But ultimately, these two men had a parting of the ways. Absalom decided to join the Episcopal Diocese of Pennsylvania. On the other hand, Richard Allen's experiences with white Methodists convinced him that he would never be treated as a full human being in a white denomination. And so he founded the African Methodist Episcopal, or AME, denomination. So Absalom had quite a journey in the Episcopal Church. His congregation, which became St. Thomas, petitioned to be admitted to the Episcopal Diocese, and he wanted the church to exercise the same level of control over its affairs as white congregations. And he also asked to enter the ordination process. He got some of those things. After 10 years as a deacon, Absalom was finally ordained as a priest in 1804. However, neither Absalom nor St. Thomas Episcopal Church received voting privileges at the Diocese of Pennsylvania's annual convention. So he was there, but not fully recognized for his gifts and his strengths. He certainly is an inspiration to me because, of course, he's the first Black person to be ordained priest in the Episcopal Church, showing us that with faith in God, we can overcome obstacles and burdens and hurdles, and yet we know it's really difficult work to do. So I'm very grateful for the life and legacy of Absalom Jones and his continued witness, even today, for us to ask who is not being fully included in our church and how can we make room for everyone. So now we're going to play a hymn that I hope that you all will enjoy. We are marching in the light of God. I thought that that would be a wonderful hymn to play this morning because, of course, Absalom Jones was a light in the world. So my special guest this morning is Dr. Catherine Meeks, who is the executive director of the Absalom Jones Center for Racial Healing. It's a ministry of the Episcopal Diocese of Atlanta. And the mission of the center is to provide tools that allow faith communities and individuals to engage in dismantling racism through education, prayer, dialogue, pilgrimage, and spiritual formation. So Dr. Meeks, welcome to Faithfully Memphis.
Well, thank you so much, Bishop Phoebe. It's such a delight to be here. I've been looking forward to this since the very day you asked if I would come and be your guest. So thank you for having me.
Me too. So can you share for our listening audience a little bit about where you grew up and the role of faith in your life?
Well, I'm happy to let your audience know that we share a state. I grew up in, I was born in El Dorado, Arkansas, and lived in Arkansas until I was 18 and then moved to California. I went to college in California and now I live in Georgia. So I think the South is where I was supposed to be because I've been here for 50 years. So I grew up, my father was a sharecropper and my mother was a school teacher, but my mother graduated from college the year that I graduated from high school. So that will give your audience a sense of the amount of struggle that she went through to get a college education. And mama never had to tell me that education was essential. I watched her all of my life work on getting a degree. And it helped me to know how important that was, even though she didn't really say a whole lot about it. My father was illiterate and used to take me with him to sign his, when he would make an X and then I would write his name for him. So it's a very, I got used to, I think, living in this kind of dichotomous environment with an educated mother who was striving for more education and a father who couldn't read or write. And it just occurs to me, just as I'm saying this, that I have learned so much about living with paradoxes. And that was certainly a big one because it's a big, you know, as a kid, for a while, I didn't know daddy couldn't read or write. But then when I found out and then he would always have me come with him to do things, which is kind of an interesting thing to have happen to you when you're a kid.
Yeah. It's, you know, you're mentioning a paradox. One of the things that has caused me to stay in the Episcopal Church, because of course I grew up in the Episcopal Church, but as an adult, you always have a choice of what faith tradition is right for you, is that it seems that we embrace the paradox, we embrace the mystery, and the questions in some sense are more important than the answers. But that's not true of every faith denomination, is it?
Absolutely not. And I could say the same thing. I became an Episcopalian as an adult, but I became an Episcopalian because I would because churches were hosting seminars on Carl Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist, whose thought I was incredibly interested in. And I thought that any church that would host those particular kinds of workshops and workshops on dreams would be a place that I would find interest in. So I started to go to services, and I loved the liturgy. And I also loved that I could use my brain, that I could think, and that I could have questions, and that no one was going to be condemning me if I raised a question that I was supposed to know the answer to. And I agree with you completely. I love what Rilke says about, you know, you need to be patient toward everything that's unsolved in your heart and learn to love the questions. Because if you will live the questions, you can maybe live into some answers someday. And I think that we mess ourselves up by thinking we have to have the answer to everything. There's some things that you just do have to live with.
Yeah, we won't know the answer to everything this side of the grave. I think if God is ultimately something, someone, some being that I can put into a box and I know all of the answers, then it really isn't God.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know, J.B. Phillips says your God's too small.
Yes.
If you can package your God and carry the God around with you, that your God's too small. So
yeah. So I invited you on the show in particular because of the amazing work that the Absalom Jones Center for Racial Healing is engaged in. So let me start by just saying we've just heard the saint of the day, Absalom Jones, the first Black Episcopal priest in the United States. And I wonder, why was the center named after Absalom Jones?
Well, we inherited the name, as a matter of fact, because the center, the Absalom Jones Center for Campus Ministry has existed for a long time. And over the years, it's changed in ways. And so instead of being a full-time ministry, it was part-time. And so when we started talking about starting the center, Bishop Wright said, let's use Absalom Jones because the building is there and it's only being used minimally. And so that's where we decided to house the center. And so then I thought, well, we will keep that name, and we will be the Absalom Jones Center for Racial Healing. Mm-hmm. And we still do campus ministry. There's a part-time campus missioner that is a part of the building as well. But, you know, I feel so honored to be running a center bearing the name of Absalom Jones. For me, it's a mandate to strive for excellence and to stand up tall and to be mm-hmm. as brave as possible because of the legacy that he left. And mm-hmm. and so it's just every day when I pull up, but I was saying this to somebody the other day, we have honored all of the folks who were lynched in Georgia. So mm-hmm. we have a monument right beside the building with everybody's name on it who was lynched, every name that we could get, that is.
Wow.
And so when I pull my car into the driveway, there's Absalom Jones and all of those names of people that are lynched. Now, you know, when I go in that building, I better be sure that I'm doing the best I can wow. to be faithful and yes. courageous and to do the best work I can do that day.
Wow. What a reminder. And it's making me think, you know, how can all of us, in a way, have daily reminders of the importance of the work that we're engaged
yes.
in?
Yes.
So I gave the sort of the official description of the center mm-hmm. that I found from your wonderful website. But I wonder, sort of in a nutshell, how would you describe the work of the center?
Well, one of the main things that I wanted our center to be is a brave space, we say, a brave space where the truth can be told. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people worry so much when you start talking about race. Can we have a safe space? That's not language that I use. I believe that when we start talking about safe spaces, we're talking about, let's see how we can get through this without really getting to the core of the matter. And mm-hmm. because if you think about this, Bishop Phoebe, the truth will disturb you.
Yes.
Period. I mean, there's no way you can engage truth, even about yourself or about anything, without mm-hmm. being disturbed. That's its purpose, to get you to see something more. And the mm-hmm. process of looking at the something more can be disturbing. So what I want is a place that's welcoming, where people know that they are loved and appreciated and welcomed, but that we will tell you the truth. We will mm-hmm. do the best we can. Our programs will not be watered down so you'll feel better. We will tell you the truth. I had I actually had a board member that finally left the board, who didn't want us to use the terminology dismantling racism, because he thought people would be more willing to get engaged with us if we called our training something else. And I said, mm-hmm. no, you know, we're not going to try to tell people that we're one thing and then be something else. We're going to be as bold as we can be. We're going to be brave, and we're going to be loving. So when you pull into our, people have told me this, when they pull into the driveway, they feel welcome.
Oh, that's great.
And they come into the building and we're burning candles and it smells good and it's beautiful. Mm-hmm. And there's coffee and snacks and programs that are designed to disturb you.
Wow.
So that's how it would describe us.
Yeah. So you talk about the truth, and I think of Jesus describing himself as the way, the truth, and the life. And also that every single person Jesus encountered, he pushed them beyond their mm-hmm. comfort zone. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so there is a time in our faith journey for us to be comforted, mm-hmm. but there's also a time for us to be challenged, mm-hmm. for us to say, all right, we've drawn the boundary. How is God inviting us to broaden our arms a little bit more? Mm-hmm. You can't get more open than Jesus's outstretched arms on the cross, right? I mean, that literally is as open as you can get. Right. So your emphasis on the truth, I would imagine, is both a challenge and opportunity.
Right. And you know, people need to know that you are willing to hold them in your heart while you're telling them, while you're teaching. I mean, I've been a teacher for a long time now, and I believe that compassionate truth telling is the only way to be, and that people will respond to that. And that's been borne out meeting after meeting after meeting. You don't have to be nasty and ugly and mm-hmm. and abusive in any kind of way. You just say what the best truth you can tell, every time you open your mouth, and be willing to stand with people as they process it. And I don't, you know, I'm not trying to demand that somebody changes or do anything. I'm just asking, inviting people the center. And a lot of what, most of what we're doing is are things that I designed. We're inviting them into interrogation. Willing to interrogate the what you believe and why you have those beliefs. And you have, if you have beliefs around believing that the systemic racism that exists in this country is a good thing, then you have an indefensible belief. And that and it needs to be interrogated, and you need to start reimagining reality. And we're going to help you in that process as best we can, if you're willing. And if you're not willing, then you will go on your way. And you know, some people are not willing, but we're willing to be with folks where we meet them, but would help them to try to get on down the road to where they need to go.
Got it. And when you say, you know, sort of this and belief or holding on to a belief in racism is indefensible. Is that tied to our baptismal covenant and the fact that as Christians and Episcopalians, that we are called to respect the dignity of every human being, to see Christ in everyone we meet? What is that belief for you tied in?
Well, it also says, and to work for peace and justice, you know, so, yes. I mean, how are we going to call ourselves ascribing to that covenant and then holding on to a notion that there's some people better than others and deserve to have resources and other people don't? And I'm always challenging myself and everybody else to decide, do you believe that there's one God who's made everybody and everybody is an equal, valuable human being in God's eyesight? Or do you think there's many gods who've made inferior people? And I think that's one of the things you have to make up your mind about. And I've made up my mind that everybody is God's beloved child. Whether I like them or not is not part of the proposition. And my job is to figure out how to see God's face in them. And particularly if I'm going to call myself a Christian, you know, I mean, just think about in terms of our history and all of those sisters and brothers of ours that are on that marker out in front of our building, those people were killed most of the time by people who sat in church houses.
Correct.
Called themselves Christians and then went out and killed other people illegally.
Yeah.
And so that's indefensible. That is completely indefensible. Mm-hmm. And holding other people in slavery is indefensible as well. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that, you know, if your ancestors had slaves, then you've just got to realize they were practicing something that shouldn't have happened. And you need to make sure that you get rid of as much of that notion of somebody deserving to be a slave or not deserving to have as good a life as you've got because they didn't work this hard or that hard. That's a game we can't afford to play.
Yeah.
I don't think, as people who have faith and claim to be following Jesus Christ,
right?
We don't get to play that game.
Yeah. So can you give us a sense of some of the types of programs that the center offers?
Well, one of the things that I'm the most proud of is something we call the Justice Pilgrimage, where we selected a group of priests and deacons from all of Province 4. Episcopalians will understand provinces, other people won't, but Province 4 covers the Southeast, so that's all the slave states. And so that's our diocese is in that province.
So is mine.
That's right. So we have 20 dioceses in Province 4. So we had 20 priests and deacons that committed to come in to be with us for a week for an intensive amount of work with lectures and films and conversations. And then we put them on a bus and took them to Savannah, to slave sites, and to Charleston, South Carolina for 2 days. And then they came back to Atlanta for some debriefing. And then they committed to spend 6 months working on being very intentional in their respective places about dismantling racism. And to come back together at the end of that 6 months to talk about what they had done and how, and they had to select a project that they were going to work on during that 6 months. Mm-hmm. I'm so proud of that, that was the pilot. And then of course, COVID has kept us from doing the next cohort. We have selected folks from provinces 1 and 3, but okay. We haven't been able to do anything because people can't travel, but we intend to do all 9 provinces before it's mm-hmm. over. And then the other thing is the youth curriculum that we've designed for 6th to 12th graders around mm-hmm. dismantling racism. And we're going to work on doing kindergarten to 5th grade. So then we will have kindergarten through 12th grade curriculum, and then mm-hmm. the dismantling racism course that we do with adults. Because I think you cannot start too early talking mm-hmm. about accepting everybody and dismantling racism. So I'm very proud of those of that curriculum. And then our dismantling racism workshop that we do, the mandated workshop that the church says everybody is supposed to take, we reimagined it to mm-hmm. include the Eucharist. So it's Eucharist centered, because all this work is about spiritual formation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not about people want to name it a lot of things, but it's basically about spiritual formation. And I think that we reimagined our training that way, and it's made such a difference in people's attitude toward it. So I am really proud of those programs, and really proud of the fact that we're just 3 years old. Mm-hmm. The center has been open 3 years, and we have worked with over 60 of the 99 dioceses in the Episcopal Church in 3 years, helping, consulting with people, working with the youth curriculum, just all kinds of other things. In addition to that, we still do just general programming around Black History Month, Women's History Month, and we do every February, we do something to re-commemorate the folks who were lynched. Mm-hmm. You know, the lynching work, the remembering the lynched is another part of the work we've done that I'm extremely proud of. And I'm hoping that every diocese will pay attention to who was lynched in their diocese mm-hmm. and do something to remember them. Yeah. I really believe we have to do that.
Yeah, I know that the work of the EJI, the Equal Justice Initiative, Brian Stevenson in Montgomery, Alabama. We have a number of Episcopalians here in West Tennessee who are involved with the Lynching Sites Project to determine where the marker is going to go for Shelby County. For those who aren't familiar with the work of EJI, they did amazing research, and they mm-hmm. have huge, I don't know if they're stone or granite, markers for every county where a man or a woman, there's some women on those right. lists as well, was lynched. And there are two mm-hmm. copies of those big, huge markers. And one is going to stay there at the museum in Montgomery. And the other is supposed to go to the county where the lynchings happened as sort of a public testimony and mm-hmm. to remember those names.
It makes me so happy to know that you all are doing that in Shelby mm-hmm. County.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So you mentioned having to sort of pivot a little bit because of COVID. Yes. And one of the things from an earlier conversation that I learned is that in a sense, COVID has opened up with the virtual Zoom or other forms of offering these programs. You've actually significantly increased the number of folks who've been able to participate.
Yes, we actually just did a little statistical analysis the other day of our reach, and we had over 3,000 people register for our offerings this past year from March until December. Wow. Had we been offering programs in the center where people would show up, we would have been lucky to have 300 people.
Wow.
Because the numbers are always small for those events. And mm-hmm. so I'm very, very grateful about that. We had a much better response in terms of donations, because we asked people for donations at the end of webinars. We don't charge for them, but we just ask, you know, mm-hmm. for you to, because we do have to raise money in order to keep the center open. And so the, all of that was just incredibly more successful than when we were in the building. So I'm really good about learning what I need to learn. So we're going to buy equipment so that when we're back in the building, we can live stream all of our programs, because we want to keep being in connection with those folks in other places. And we have people sign up for our workshops in from West Africa, Canada, Latin America, and all over the United States. And of course you can't do that on site. So, but it's really been a good thing for us to see. And I'm really, really grateful for people's response to our work over this past year. And that we had that much success, because when we first had to close the center, I was really worried about how am I supposed to keep a center open when we can't be there to work? And I found out, so.
That's great. So I think next week are moving into the season of Lent. Mm-hmm. And I think my question, or stump the bishop question for today after our interview, is gonna have to do with the season of Lent. Mm-hmm. But I understand that you all have recently launched a new initiative that is focusing on health mm-hmm. as a means of strengthening us and preparing us to fight, to combat the evil of racism. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, why did you decide to focus on health in your most recent initiative?
Well, it's health, and we're calling it wellness because we want to talk about spiritual, mental, and physical health. And so many times we're preoccupied with physical health, but we don't pay much attention to mental health and spiritual well-being and health. Mm-hmm. And I think our country is in a space right now where to talk about wellness is so important. I believe that just look at what's been going on, and here we are and still in the midst of COVID. So I think it's a good thing for us to kind of shift our gear mm-hmm. and turn toward getting ourselves completely well. You know, really getting my mind and my body and my soul on the same track, going in the same direction. Uh-huh. So I've been saying to my staff, we want to give wellness a press agent. We want wellness. We want to promote wellness, and we want wellness to be on everybody's mind. Mm-hmm. And we want to talk about, you know, we're not trying to say go do this or that. We're saying think about your life from this holistic point of view, and think about if you work on being well, you're not going to be so concerned about hating somebody mm-hmm. or wishing somebody ill, because you can't go around wishing people ill and call yourself being well. And mm-hmm. so we have called this the Murphy Davis Let's Get Well campaign. And Murphy Davis was a warrior woman who died in October after a 25-year battle with cancer, but who managed to be well in many ways, even though her physical body was not well, because mm-hmm. her spirit and her soul, her mind and her soul were really focused on working for people who were in prison and on death row and people who were homeless. And she was mm-hmm. just an amazing soul. So the center is honoring her by naming our campaign in honor of her. But I'm working to get everybody everywhere, anywhere on board with this. And mm-hmm. and we're going to health organizations, pharmaceutical companies, athletic groups, churches, fraternities, media. Everybody needs to be engaged in this campaign. Mm-hmm. And some people will remember when John Kennedy was president, and we were trying to worry about the Russians beating us to the moon. And we thought that America was fat and flabby and we needed to do something about ourselves. And we had this major physical fitness mm-hmm. initiative that, and I think that even the Olympics, the Special Olympics, maybe got started sometime in that mm-hmm. whole era. And President Kennedy formed the President's Council on Physical Fitness. So I want maybe to get the president to form a council on wellness. You mm-hmm. know, I think that we need to have that kind of campaign where it's on everybody's mind and we're talking about it. And as we emerge from COVID too, but then the racism that's just walking around saying, look at me, I'm here to stay. We need mm-hmm. to be saying, no, you don't get to stay because we're going to get well.
Yeah, yeah. So if people are interested in learning more about, you know, this initiative or any of the other programs offered by the center, how might they learn more?
Well, for one thing, the very first thing people can do is visit our website, mm-hmm. which is centerforracialhealing.org. And if you, as soon as you type C-E-N-T, it'll center will come up because it's been accessed enough now that it comes up really fast.
Great.
So centerforracialhealing.org. And then there's everything is there and how to contact us and everything. And we're certainly willing to be in conversation with everybody and anybody about this work. And anybody who wants to get engaged in our wellness campaign, I really would welcome their getting in touch with me and want to help spread the word, because this is a PR campaign that I'm talking about. This is not here's a curriculum, go do it. This is wake up, be conscious, and look at yourself and see what you can do about being a more well human being.
Mm-hmm. So it's really a holistic approach to who we are as embodied human beings.
That's right. That's right. And you know, this is pitiful to be coming to church every Sunday, but then to or engaging in worship and being filled with anxiety and having a whole bunch of negative thoughts about everything and everybody. That's a pitiful way to live. And it really is important, I think, for us to start trying to get ourselves in balance. Mm-hmm. Because when you are in balance, then you begin to see everything differently. And so I just think, Bishop Phoebe, we just got to get back to some basics here.
Yeah.
And start saying, look, we're on a bad pathway in this country. We cannot afford to keep on having people feeling like some people deserve to die because they don't agree with them and all that. That's a whole lot of nonsense. And we've got to switch gears out of that space.
Yeah. I think, it seems to me when we see people who are really angry, I've had friends in the therapy world tell me that what really is the underpinning of a lot of anger is actually fear.
Yes.
Fear is driving so much of what we see. And even persons of deep faith mm-hmm. have so much anxiety about the state of conditions, either globally or in mm-hmm. their community, or the issues they're facing right in their own home, mm-hmm. being cooped up because of COVID. So I wonder, Dr. Meeks, you know, given everything that's happening in the world, what is allowing you to stay hopeful, to not give mm-hmm. into a spirit of fear or despair or hopelessness?
Well, you know, there's a lovely story about Frederick Douglass standing and talking about how bad everything was for Black people. And Sojourner Truth was in the back of the church where he was speaking. And Sojourner Truth stood up and said to him, Frederick, is God dead? And, and if God is not dead, then there's always a chance for things to be different. So that's sort of where I am. God mm-hmm. is not dead. As far as I can tell, God is not dead. And it's not up to me anyway. It's up to me to be faithful. It's up to me to keep on doing what I know to do. And then the big thing for me is that I don't expect this world to be the kingdom of God. You know, mm-hmm. this world is the empire. This world is not God's kingdom. My job is to try to help God's kingdom to come. That's what mm-hmm. we say every day when we're praying the Lord's Prayer. Mm-hmm. And so I'm grounded in that my job is to work to make this place better, but this is not God's kingdom. And so I think a lot of people have invested in this world as if it's all there is.
Mm-hmm.
And when things start to go awry, that destroys them. And mm-hmm. and I just don't have that. I just don't have that sense of if everything goes away. If you think about, well, what's the worst thing that can happen? Well, I don't even know if dying is the worst thing that can happen to you. I think there are other things that could be worse, but we tend to think that dying is the worst thing. So if I die, I die. But up to that point, I just need to be trying to live my life with as much faith and grace as possible. And it's been like, I'm like everybody. I'm tired of COVID. I'm tired of being in the house. But I was thinking this morning, I could live anywhere. I could, because eventually I've just realized home is where I am with God. Mm-hmm. And that's what keeps me going. And the work that I do, I know for an absolute fact that this is the work I'm called to do. And I'm grateful for the grace and the stamina. I'll be 75 week after next. And I feel better than I ever have, you know? So that's, you know, I'm thankful. It's grace and mercy and a faith that, you know, that I put my foot down and there's ground. And if I take another step, there'll be ground. And because God is not dead.
Well, happy early birthday. And I love that question of Sojourner Truth, you know, is God dead? And thanks be to God, God is not dead. That's so we want to just thank you for your persistence and willingness to engage in this work and the invitation that you have now extended to all of us to figure out ways that we can be engaged and also to get healthy. Can 2021 be the year that we all get healthy?
Yes, and thank you so much too, Bishop Phoebe. I want to say, so that your audience can hear me say, how grateful I am for your faith and your way of leading your flock in the Diocese of West Tennessee. That's another thing that helps me to keep having faith, is to see my sisters and brothers around the church really stepping up to the plate and really being courageous and being willing to disturb people but because you know that that's what you're called to do. So I really do appreciate you and the way that you have gone about being a bishop.
Oh, thank you. And so we're certain, I've been able to participate in several of your programs virtually. And I think even before COVID, I was down in Atlanta for a conference and you had me as a presenter along with some other amazing women. So I'm looking forward to the time when enough of the vaccine has been administered so that we can travel a little bit more so I can come back to Atlanta.
Yes, we'll be glad to have you.
Well, thanks again for this conversation. And now I think we are going to go into another hymn.
Jordan, the
that beautiful song, Deep River, by Paul Robeson, the incomparable Paul Robeson, is one of Dr. Meek's favorite songs, which is why we selected it. So now this segment of our program is called Stump the Bishop. It's when I get a question from someone who is interested either in knowing something about me or something about the church. And the question for this week is, what is the connection between Mardi Gras and Lent? And that is a fabulous question. So for those of you who may not know, I lived in New Orleans, Louisiana for 13 years. I was there initially as a laywoman and then went through the discernment and ordination process in the Diocese of Louisiana and returned to do my first stint as a priest at a church in New Orleans. And so I had 13 years of being there for Mardi Gras. So Mardi Gras actually means Fat Tuesday in French. And as we know, that whole portion of the United States, the Louisiana Territory, was owned at one point by the French before President Thomas Jefferson purchased it during his tenure. And Fat Tuesday or Mardi Gras is the day before Ash Wednesday. And Ash Wednesday officially begins the season of Lent. So next week, Tuesday, February the 16th, is Fat Tuesday. Now, during normal circumstances, this upcoming weekend would be the height of Mardi Gras in New Orleans, with all kinds of parades and balls and fun activities. And because of COVID, they haven't had to cancel Mardi Gras, but they've had to cancel all of the public group activities connected with Mardi Gras, because of course, Fat Tuesday is still gonna happen next week. And many churches will have a Shrove Tuesday or Fat Tuesday pancake supper the day before Ash Wednesday. The reason being is that the season of Lent is a penitential season when we are asked to relinquish or give up certain things so that we can really focus on our relationship with God and to prepare our hearts and minds and souls for what will happen during Holy Week, which of course involves Jesus's death, but then also his resurrection. But it's a real season of penitence and examining where we are. In fact, a lot of the things that Dr. Meeks talked about in her interview, just us being real about where we are in terms of our relationship with God, where we are in terms of our relationship with neighbor, where we are in terms of our own physical, emotional, and spiritual health. So typically you would try to get rid of all of the good stuff that you want to eat. So the butter, the sugar, the syrup. So many people give up sweets for Lent that on Fat Tuesday or Shrove Tuesday, you have a pancake supper because that uses up some of the forbidden foods that you're not supposed to have. And during Lent, meat is traditionally given up certainly on Fridays, but you know, you could always have lots of seafood in South Louisiana. So that never was really much of a sacrifice to have fish on Fridays instead of meat, because I love all kinds of fish. So Mardi Gras is sort of the holiday part of getting us to start the season of Lent. And I hope that all of you all will consider some form of Lenten discipline this year. You can give up something such as sugar or sodas or alcohol, but you know, you could also give up something a little more significant. You could give up anger speaking angrily to people, or you could give up social media, what would that feel like if you took a 40-day break from Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat, and instead use that time for reading, for service projects? There are lots of things that we can do with our time. So think about giving up something that is significant. Not to say that giving up soda is insignificant. Some of us do drink too much soda, but there are more substantial things that you can give up. But you can also, as part of your Lenten discipline, take something on. So you can take on reading the Bible every day during the season of Lent. One year, I took on the discipline of writing a short handwritten note to someone I cared about every day and put it in snail mail. Because so often we get emails from people and we get magazines or advertisements in snail mail, but it's unusual to get a handwritten card or note. So that was a discipline that I took on several years ago, and people really commented about how powerful that was to get a short note. So think about either giving up something or taking on something that will be a blessing to others and will also help each of us get healthier, as Dr. Meeks recommended. So now we're going to have another hymn.
In the memory of my father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, and Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, I'd like to sing one of his favorites, a song that he'd always request, a song with long, strong arms that rocked him in the cradle of ages. Precious. Lord, take my hand and lead. hear my cry, Lord. And Lord, hear my cry. Lest I fall, take my hand. Yeah, precious Lord.
Precious Lord, precious Lord.
Lord Jesus, and lead.
Was the one and only Ms. Aretha Franklin. So I do want to give a special shout out this morning to Shelby McCall. You know, we are actually having an ice storm in Memphis. Woke up to find the trees and the streets covered with ice. And so Dr. Catherine Meeks and I were able to do this call remotely. But shout out to Shelby for being in the studio and facilitating our show this morning. And our diocesan communicator, Emily Austin, has compiled a comprehensive, wonderful list of Lenten opportunities being offered by the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee. Most of them are virtual Lenten quiet mornings or book clubs, book studies, but a few of them are in person. A wonderful variety of offerings for youth and adults from the congregations from throughout West Tennessee. Those of you who are on our diocesan email distribution list should have received that email this morning. But if you're not a part of our diocesan email distribution list and you would like to have this particular email sent to you so that you can learn about ways that you might take on a new Lenten discipline this year. If you call the diocesan office at 901-937-4700 and give us your email address, we would be happy to share this list with you. And again, Lent begins next week on Wednesday. So until next week, my brothers and sisters, stay safe and stay positive.
This is Elliot Ives, JT and the Tennessee Kids.